Mr. Kerry goes to Baghdad today, Monday, June 23rd. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. wants a more inclusive Iraq, but Secretary of State John Kerry says Washington won't pick Iraq's next leader.
Neither the United States nor any other country has the right to pick who leads Iraq. That is up to the people of Iraq.
Also, an Iraqi student now in the U.S. remembers growing up in a country without deep sectarian divides.
I remember asking my mom, what does it mean to be a Shia? What does it mean to be a Sunni? And she said, we didn't know these differences. We didn't ask our neighbors if they were Sunni or Shia.
Plus, what it was like this spring to see the Colorado River flow where it hasn't flowed for decades.
It was amazing. It was a magical experience because we got to see a river coming back to life.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The United States seems to be of two minds on Iraq. You've got Washington offering its support to the Shiite-dominated Iraqi government in its fight against Sunni militants, but you've also got the White House saying that support will only be delivered to a more inclusive government in Baghdad. Officially, though, Secretary of State John Kerry is staying neutral.
As I told Iraqi leaders today, and as I've made clear to my counterparts in the region, neither the United States nor any other country has the right to pick who leads Iraq. That is up to the people of Iraq.
Meanwhile, the ISIS militants continue to advance on Baghdad, their latest conquest, a key crossing on the border with Jordan, one of Iraq's neighbors to its west. The BBC's Richard Galpin is in Baghdad. He says ISIS has shifted its focus west in recent days.
Certainly, there's been almost a clean sweep by the militants in this province of Anbar, and they are taking more and more towns heading towards the western side of Baghdad. And one sheikh in the city of Ramadi, which is in Anbar province, a prominent figure, was saying they're fighting with ISIS for the moment, and the decisive battles are going to come in the days ahead. And he was saying the next battle would be at the gates of Baghdad.
So I imagine jitters are pretty high in Baghdad right now.
Yes, I think people are concerned that the militants will try to launch some kind of attack into Baghdad. Although I think there are plenty of people are skeptical about it because they think they will not be able to launch any kind of successful offensive because in Baghdad, not only, of course, do you have a lot of troops, but there are a very large number of Shiite militiamen. There was a huge demonstration by one of the militia over the weekend with tens of thousands of their men on the streets here, armed to the teeth with, you know, every single different type of weapon you could imagine. So it would be an enormous battle if the Sunni militants would try to break in, but they may try and do it.
How well organized are those Shiite militias? And do they see themselves aligned with the government of Maliki, or do they see themselves as kind of a vigilante force to fight ISIS?
Certainly the one we went to go and see, this is the Mahdi army of Muqtadir al-Sadr, who were out on the streets in force over the weekend. The people there we interviewed were saying, we don't take our orders from the Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki, even though he's a fellow Shiite. No, we do not. We take our orders only from our leader. So it's totally about what their leader tells them to do.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is a busy man the last 24 hours. He's had high-level meetings and is in Baghdad today with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. What kind of clout does Kerry have with him?
Well, I think he does have pretty significant influence, given the history, obviously, of American involvement here and the fact it has a lot of money to potentially could put in here and the weaponry as well. And the Iraqi government is desperate for the United States to intervene militarily.
Now, the U.S. says that for national security interests, American national security, it's got to stop the advances of ISIS. So does the Iraqi government. That's essentially propping up Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, a man who the U.S. has said needs to do much more to be inclusive in uniting Iraq. I mean, isn't that paradoxical?
I don't think so. I don't think it necessarily means keeping Nouri al-Maliki in power. And I think some of the signals we've had is that the Americans in some ways would be not unhappy if he were to be removed from power. The question, though, I think at the moment is who would replace Nouri al-Maliki. At the moment, there aren't really sort of very clear figures who stand out as being potentially much more inclusive. There are some names being bandied around. So let's see. In some ways, I think, yes, maybe they do feel that they need to keep Nouri al-Maliki at the moment for some kind of continuity. But obviously, there'll be massive pressure on him to change his policies that he cannot, as far as the international community is concerned, or certain Western powers are concerned, continue with this kind of Shiite-only policy, which has marginalized particularly the Sunni community, leading in part to the crisis which we're seeing at the moment with the in what has increasingly become a sort of broader Sunni rebellion against the government.
The BBC's Richard Galpin in Baghdad, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
The deep religious and ethnic divisions that haunt Iraq today weren't always as apparent. In fact, Shamiran Mako didn't know about them as a child growing up there. Mako is a PhD student at the University of Edinburgh and a research fellow at Northeastern University here in Boston. She stopped by the World Studios to talk about her Iraq.
I grew up enjoying all sorts of cultural and religious activities of people from our surrounding neighborhoods. We had neighbors who were Turkmen, who were Kurds, who were Arabs, who were, Assyrians. And the rich cultural diversity that we grew up with was something that we cherished. Christians would join in celebrating, Ramadan and vice versa. And so I grew up with these sort of very vivid memories of enjoying these different festivities with our neighbors. And as school children, you kind of learn to celebrate that. And we didn't really know about these differences. We just knew that this is what people did and these were people's traditions.
And these days, all we seem to hear about Iraq is the sectarian divides between people. Did you detect any tension when you were growing up in this diversity?
No. We didn't know if our neighbors who were Arab were Shia or Sunni. And this is something that I think most Iraqis can speak to. I've spoken with my parents. I've spoken with relatives who grew up, throughout the 1940s, 50s, 60s. They also didn't know. I was born in Basra and I grew up in Kirkuk. And I remember asking my mom, what does it mean to be a Shia? What does it mean to be a Sunni? And she said, we didn't know these differences. We didn't ask our neighbors if they were Sunni or Shia.
How did that make you identify yourself? Did you ask your parents, what are we? Or did it matter? Did they care?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. My family is Assyrian. We're the sort of small native Christian community of Iraq. And we spoke Aramaic or Assyrian at home. And so there was a language difference there. But we knew that this is the ethnic or community that we belong to. But at the same time, it wasn't necessarily something that was heightened. And so people just knew that these differences existed, but they weren't necessarily something that was bad. And so growing up, we knew that we were Iraqis, but at the same time, Iraqi also meant being Assyrian, being Kurd, being Turkoman, being Yazidi, etc.
So it's kind of all about the melting pot in many ways. It's very similar to the United States, people from all these different kind of like roots coming together.
Absolutely. And I think one of the sort of biggest points of contention was the regime itself. You had a one-party Sunni-dominated Arab regime that...
Saddam Hussein's regime
that tried to impose the melting pot. And I think that had different reverberating effects that we started seeing post-2003. I would say that the contention at that point was more with the regime itself and trying to suppress these different ethnic religious differences rather than with the people themselves.
So do you have family back in Iraq still?
I have extended family.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Are you talking to them and how are they feeling?
Yeah, we've spoken with them. Most of them are in the Nineveh region or the Nineveh Plains region.
Which is where in relation to Baghdad?
So it's above Mosul. And it's probably a couple of hundred kilometers north of Baghdad. And they are also very disheartened to see this happening. There's an estimated 500,000 people have become displaced from Mosul. And it's an estimated population of about 2 million people. So that's quite substantive. And the number's growing. And so there's massive internal displacement. And amongst that, so there are a lot of Sunni Arabs who are trying to seek refuge in the Kurdish-controlled region. But for the Assyrians and the Yazidis and the Turkmans, these sort of smaller communities, they're really feeling the brunt of it because so many of their community members have already left. And so for the few relatives that I have left, you know, they see this as an ongoing problem, and they see this as a problem that's only going to continue to affect the massive sort of outpouring of Iraqis into neighboring countries.
So I'm curious to know, Shamaran, what is the discussion among Iraqis who are not in Iraq, like the Iraqis you speak to here? What are they saying about what's going on right now?
They're a bit shocked about the visceral response that we're seeing as a result of these different factions that are behind the underlying causes of this violence. They're also in shock that over the past 10 years, there hasn't really been much of socioeconomic development, alleviating poverty, boosting education, especially the ones who have left, you know, a while ago, a couple of decades ago or a decade ago. It's disheartening for them to see that no progress has been made.
Shamaran Mako, thanks very much for coming in. It was great to meet you.
Thank you. Likewise.
That was Shamaran Mako, an Iraqi student and a research fellow at Northeastern University here in Boston. So many Iraqis didn't used to see a Sunni-Shia divide in their country, and you don't see that divide now among Muslims living here in the U.S. My colleague Aaron Schachter visited a mosque in Boston to ask why there are such divisions in the Middle East, while here everyone does seem to just get along.
The Yusuf Mosque in the Brighton section of Boston is an almost shocking mix of cultures in a city that often seems fairly uniform. Drive by on a Friday afternoon, prayer day, and you'll see men and women from across the Muslim world, from Indonesia to Iraq to North Africa, in a wide variety of dress. There are jeans and T-shirts, jalabiyas, shalwar kameez, headscarves, and niqabs. I sat down with a few men at lunch after services to ask why. Why do the different Islamic sects seem to get along here, but, in extreme cases, kill each other back home? Anwar Faisal is Palestinian.
In Iraq, or in Syria, or Yemen, or Libya, these countries, people looking for power. And when you have the power, you have a lot to think. You have the wealth coming with the power. You have loyalty. Our mentality as a Middle Eastern, people love power.
Faisal says many of the Muslim nations remain third world countries without rule of law or effective government institutions. So they're vulnerable to unscrupulous leaders who divide people along religious fault lines. In the U.S., he says, people may call themselves liberal or conservative, but they don't care who you call God.
The people here, people of America, they believe they are under one God. It doesn't make difference what God you are praying for. You have a temple, you have a mosque, you have a church.
All on this block.
Yes. Second, they are under one flag. And that is the key. Make this country is the most beautiful country on the planet.
Yusuf Nasrallah from Pakistan adds that a national identity supersedes a religious or tribal one for Muslims in the U.S.
They have lived with non-Muslim communities, and they're like, okay, you have your rights as a minority, I have mine, and we are all contributing. That is what keeps people humane and civilized in this part of the world.
Why people get along here when they come to this country, when they migrate or immigrate to this country.
That's Imam Ismail Feni from Algeria.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with when you're not in your, when you are a fish out of your bowl, you do what you can to survive. And I think it's true about anyone, any ethnicity, regardless of religion. You try to make do until you get back to your fish bowl.
Feni says it may take the Muslim world generations until their different fishbowls are free from religious violence. But hey, says Riyad Tubeshat from Jordan, America had its own problems back in the day.
Keep in mind, America, how long it took. We have a big civil war here. Keep in mind, most of these countries right now, they're very new to political structure. So they didn't have enough time. And they have so much outside influence.
It's been hundreds of years since the U.S. shook off a colonial power. These men say you got to give Islamic countries some time to catch up. For The World, I'm Aaron Schachter.
This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI and supported by TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen, available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The whole planet is connected, and this next story surely shows how the U.S. is connected to Mexico through water. Once upon a time, the Colorado River Delta was one of the largest and most vibrant wetlands in North America. Its mouth sits at the north end of the Sea of Cortez in Mexico, where the Colorado empties out, after passing through seven U.S. states. But over time, huge dams were built along the river, and every single drop of the Colorado was siphoned off to feed growing cities and farms in the southwest and Mexico. In other words, for the past two generations now, the place where the Great River used to meet the sea has basically been a desert. But this spring, a few threads of the Delta began to spring back to life. Jill Replogle of KPBS in San Diego has a story of why and what's been happening since.
About 150 miles east of San Diego, Morelos Dam stops the Colorado River in its tracks, right at the U.S.-Mexico border. Here, the last stretch of the once mighty river is diverted from its natural path into an irrigation canal, bound for Mexican farms. It's been this way for most of the last half century. Below the dam, most of the river's delta from here to the Gulf of California, 100 miles away, is usually dry as a bone. But then, for a few weeks this spring, it suddenly wasn't.
It was amazing. It was a magical experience because we got to see a river coming back to life.
Jamilet Carrillo heads the Colorado River Delta Water Trust, a coalition of Mexican and U.S. environmental groups. She helped convince the governments of the two countries to try a one-time experiment, open up the Morelos Dam for 2 months to mimic the floods that used to flow into the delta every spring, and see what would happen.
We haven't had a river for decades, so you can imagine we are learning a lot about the river, how it behaves, where it moves, how the ecosystem responds.
So this is our seed traps.
The flood is over now, and about 10 miles south of the dam, Alejandra Calvo and Juan Butron are part of the effort to learn about its impact. They're checking out a piece of plywood covered in a sticky substance and mounted in the sand where the water rushed through.
We look for the seeds of cottonwoods and willows.
Water-loving cottonwoods and willows used to thrive here. The release was timed to match the season when the few trees still in the area disperse their seeds. If some settle here, new trees could take root in the damp soil. But no luck here today.
And no cottonwood or willow here?
No, en este no.
But they may yet find seeds here, and they have found them elsewhere. In any case, scientists didn't expect the experiment to be perfectly successful. Ecosystem restoration is a slow and uncertain business. Carrillo and others will be studying the effects of this spring's flood for years, watching for the return of trees, birds, and other native species. But they won't just be watching. They'll also be lending a hand. Farther south in the delta, several women splash down a channel carrying pallets of slender, foot-high willow trees. Guadalupe Fonseca of the Arizona-based Sonoran Institute digs holes for the saplings in the riverbank. His team will plant more than 1,000 trees here today. The big flood has ended, Fonseca says, but this site is still being fed with a smaller amount of water that's being delivered here via one of the irrigation canals that crisscross the delta. That was the second part of the deal that made this spring's flood possible. Conservation groups are acquiring water rights from farmers and sending that water back into the river, so at least a trickle will flow through parts of the delta over the next 4 years. It all adds up to a very small step in the very big task of restoring at least a few pockets of the delta to something like their former selves, a task that's only getting harder as water stresses in the region get worse. But conservation groups here say they have already begun to show what's possible. Juliana Dimas of the Mexican conservation group ProNatura points out 30-foot-tall cottonwood trees planted here a few years ago. The trees are full of birds. Birds are among the best indicators of ecosystem health, Dimas says. We hear lots of them here. Jamilet Carrillo says conservation groups already scored one unexpected victory in their quest. In May, water from the Colorado reached the Gulf of California for the first time in decades.
So that was a major celebration for everybody working on this, because it's something that we wanted, but we knew that maybe the flows are not going to be enough.
The scientists working here have the rest of the summer to come up with a first report on whether the flood experiment is working. The results will help policymakers decide whether or not it's worth repeating in the future. But Carrillo says she already knows the answer.
It is working. When you begin walking down the river and you see the little seedlings coming out of the soil, you know that it is working.
For the world, I'm Jill Replogle, Algodones, Mexico.
Let's head farther south for our geoquiz now, specifically the capital of the eastern Mexican state of Veracruz. This city's got a long history dating back before the Aztecs, and for a long time it's been known for its hot chilies. These peppers show up in local dishes like chiles rellenos, not your deep-fried poppers. We're talking green, hot peppers stuffed with salsa and fish caught in the Gulf of Mexico. Reporter Beto Arcos recently watched as local chef Pepe Ochoa prepared to make the dish.
Voy a preparar el relleno para unos chiles jalapeños en frío.
Pepe's about to start making the filling for the chiles, starting with sautéing the onion in olive oil. So he's throwing some bay leaf into the onion as it's being sautéed.
And while that sizzles away and Beto gets hungrier, you should know that we posted a recipe for these chiles rellenos at PRI.org. And the answer to our quiz, in case you haven't guessed it yet, is Jalapa, the city that lends its name to jalapenos. Beto says the jalapenos Chef Pepe prepares are nothing like the pickled ones you're used to.
I'm about to have one of these fantastic chiles jalapenos cooked by this fantastic chef from Veracruz. Pepe, this is amazing. Maravilloso. So as I'm eating this, I'm able to taste all of these ingredients that Pepe has put into these chiles. Onion, garlic, capers, olives, sautéed in olive oil, oregano, thyme, white wine.
Dry
white wine. Okay, correction. And then you just dig in just like I am doing right now. And I'm telling you, I hope that by the next time you see jalapeno, you will remember that you can do many things with jalapenos. Enjoy it with a fantastic glass of wine. Pepe, muchas gracias.
No, hombre, gracias a ti por poder llevar a través de esta transmisión un poco del sabor de Veracruz y de México.
Oh, thanks to you, he says, for being able to take a little bit of the flavor of Veracruz and Mexico around the world. And now you know where the name comes from. I'm Beto Arcos, eating chiles jalapeños in Jalapa, Veracruz.
What a lucky duck. Beto is also a jalapeño because he's from Jalapa, like the chilies. Wish I could say that. I can say that it is the world on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, Hebrew. It's got a unique history, as the editors of its historical dictionary know all too well. The language was dormant for centuries.
Hebrew, for 1,700 years, wasn't spoken by anyone. Some people call it was a dead language. But if it was dead, it was a very lively corpse.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, Hebrew. It's got a unique history, as the editors of its historical dictionary know all too well. The language was dormant for centuries.
Hebrew, for 1,700 years, wasn't spoken by anyone. Some people call it was a dead language. But if it was dead, it was a very lively corpse.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org. and by Lookout, working to protect people and organizations from mobile threats with 50 million users worldwide. More information at lookout.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. For decades, the United States has considered Egypt a close ally, but the alliance is definitely strained right now. The latest evidence, the guilty verdicts announced today in Cairo against three journalists who work for the Al Jazeera TV network. The three were each sentenced to 7 years on terrorism-related charges. The verdict came one day after Secretary of State John Kerry visited Cairo and spoke about the case with Egypt's new president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, apparently to no effect. Shira Frankel is Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed and is based in Cairo.
I think Secretary of State John Kerry visiting Egypt, saying he had had a fruitful discussion with recently elected President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, really sort of pushed people to a mindset that, well, okay, if Kerry's come into town and the U.S. has kind of made these overtures, maybe we have reason to be optimistic. And it was quite disappointing today to find out that that was not the case.
Well, it's a tough one for Kerry because the sentence came out just as he had been appealing for the release of the defendant. So he's condemned the verdict, but what's he doing actually to kind of push back against this crackdown on civil liberties and freedom of speech?
You know, that's an excellent question. The other day when Kerry was in Egypt, he said that they were releasing $575 million in military aid to Egypt, and even said at one point that very soon they would have the Apache helicopters that have been held up for quite some time now. Those are all sweeteners. Those are all things that Egypt's wanted, and Kerry seemed to be very much saying yesterday that they were going to be getting those things. Mm. At no point today, despite his shock, did they say that any of that aid would be withdrawn? Did they say that those helicopters would not be delivered? The U.S., if it wanted to, does have wiggle room here. It can show its displeasure in other ways, but they haven't chosen to do so.
Right. But I mean, there's also the news on Saturday, which has now been kind of eclipsed by the Al Jazeera verdicts, that these 183 death sentences confirmed for more than 180 members and supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood. That's related to violence in Egypt last summer. How's the public in Cairo reacting to what must seem to be just disproportionately harsh sentences all around?
Well, you know, it's quite interesting because the Egyptian judiciary traditionally wasn't known for this kind of thing. The Egyptian public had quite a bit of faith in the judiciary. Even during the days of Mubarak, when there were court sentences that were quite radical, people seemed to believe that Egypt's courts would remain independent. And over the last 6 months, we've seen verdict after verdict that has led to sort of shock in the Egyptian public. Quite a few Egyptians that I spoke to today said, oh, well, you know, it's just the journalists and it's just the Muslim Brotherhood and we think we'll still be okay. So they seem to be kind of holding out hope that this is a crackdown on other people and that it won't reach them. But among the human rights workers and certainly among legal experts, there's a lot of shock and a lot of concern over what they can do to confront what they see as a rash of very radical rulings by the judiciary.
Wow. So a lot of Egypt in denial.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, look, a lot of Egypt is still celebrating Sisi's ascendancy to the presidency. They're still hoping that Sisi can sort of wave his magic wand and that everything in Egypt will get better. I mean, Egypt is still dealing with daily blackouts. In a couple of days, we're going to be starting Ramadan. People will be fasting all day. And there's reports that the blackouts could be worse than ever. I really can't imagine many things worse than sitting around in the dead heat of summer in Egypt, fasting with no electricity or AC to cool you down. So if there is going to be a backlash or I think at least displeasure voiced in public against Sisi, I do expect it to come during the next month or two when some of the sheen of his presidency might wear off a little bit.
Yeah, so with all of this as a backdrop, as you said, the U.S. has unfrozen more than $550 million in military aid for Sisi. What exactly is the state of the U.S.-Egypt relationship right now?
Well, the U.S. seems to be really pushing to restore full diplomatic ties with Egypt, and there's any number of reasons that I'm sure analysts will tell you that they're doing so. On the other hand, the U.S. said that it wants to see Egypt on this democratic path. It wants to see a transition towards democracy, I think were the words used by the State Department. And they've had case after case, incident after incident, that have caused them problems, that if they do want to declare at this point that Egypt is, in fact, democratic and that it is moving towards a democratic transition, the sentencing to death of hundreds of those isn't going to help them to do so.
Pull back for us just a little bit, Shira. How do these harsh sentences and just what seems to be, you know, just throwing all civil rights in the garbage can in Egypt play into regional jitters like Iraq and Syria, where the rule of law right now is also in serious doubt.
Certainly in the actions of what we've seen John Kerry do in the last few days and in further back, the congressional delegations that we've seen to Egypt, there has been a lot of outreach from the United States to Egypt. So perhaps they are very concerned with maintaining that relationship at the expense of everything else.
How do these verdicts against a journalist make you as a foreign journalist feel right now, Shira?
Oh, it's terrifying. I mean, if nothing else, it's a message to all of us who practice journalism in Egypt that we could be next. I think that, you know, Egypt's foreign ministry said it very, very clearly when they said that this was a deterrent sentence. They've handed down a judgment which is unimaginable for any of those of us who sat in the courtroom and saw the evidence against the three Al Jazeera journalists. At no point was there any shred of evidence that showed that these three men had been engaged in anything other than objective reporting in Egypt. It is truly scary.
Shira Frankel is the Mideast correspondent for BuzzFeed. Thanks a lot for your time, Shira.
Thank you.
We're going to switch gears now a bit for a story about language. You know, if you want to look up the meaning of a word, you check the dictionary. A good dictionary, like, say, the Oxford English Dictionary, will even fill you in on the history of the word. In Israel, though, linguists are in over their heads, putting together a similar dictionary for the Hebrew language. To find out why, we turn to reporter Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
The English language, as we know it, has been around about 860 years. That's a pretty long time.
Without bragging, the history of Hebrew is much older.
More than three times older, says Gabriel Birnbaum. He's a senior researcher at Israel's official Academy of the Hebrew Language. His job is to write the entries for the Hebrew Historical Dictionary. 4 days a week, 7 hours a day, he sits alone in his small office, surrounded by dusty volumes of ancient Hebrew texts, and types out definitions.
The ideal is to have all the words with all their history, how they started, when they started to be used, the whole of the treasure of the Hebrew language. The English have it, the French have it, and the Hungarians have it, so we should also have it.
Hebrew was born around the 12th century BC. It's the language of the Bible. Jesus knew Hebrew. But a few decades after Jesus' death, Jews were exiled from the Holy Land, and they adopted different languages.
Hebrew, for 1,700 years, wasn't spoken by anyone. Some people call it was a dead language. But if it was dead, it was a very lively corpse.
Because it really wasn't dead at all. Jews wrote their literature and liturgy in Hebrew. They recited prayers in Hebrew. They still do, at the Western Wall, the major Jewish holy site in Jerusalem. In the late 19th century, waves of Jews moved to the Holy Land and revived Hebrew as a spoken language. But how do you order ice cream in an ancient tongue?
They didn't have words for office or for eyeglasses or for matches. So from where will we take this? So, of course, we can coin new words. But first, we have to use all the words that we have in our sources.
That's how the mysterious biblical word chashmal, referring to God appearing with fire and light, became the modern word for electricity. And there's an ancient Aramaic translation of a biblical passage describing manna from heaven as thin as frost. Frost in Aramaic is glida. Today, glida is the frosty stuff you order at the ice cream parlor. The woman behind the counter says she's got full-fat glida, sugar-free glida, sorbet glida. Hebrew is based on roots, patterns of letters that are the building blocks of the language. So the three-letter combination in the word write also appears in the words for article and journalist and letter and spelling and address and anything having to do with writing. More than half of those letter combinations in modern Hebrew comes straight from the Bible. That's how Hebrew differs from English, Birnbaum says.
If I give you a text of Old English, you won't understand a word, because those words have changed a lot. Now, you take an Israeli child, you give him a text from the book of Genesis, he can understand, let's say, not to exaggerate, 70% of it. He can understand it.
The Hebrew Language Academy began compiling its historical dictionary in 1959. It only came out with a first edition in 2005. There are a lot of words from the past few thousand years to comb through. And then there are all the new words of the past century. Linguists at the Hebrew Language Academy are still coining new words for terms that didn't exist in the Bible or the Middle Ages. And Israelis often email the Language Academy to request new words. Staffer Tzipi Senderov says lately there's been high demand for one particular word.
People always write the same thing. I need to know the Hebrew term for cupcake. Then we have to say there is no alternative, and people are like, why? Can't you find an alternative?
So they did. The Academy has posted two options online for the public to choose from. So far, the more popular choice is ugonit. In English, it translates to mini cake. The other contender is muffin mekushat, decorated muffin.
Do you think these two alternatives sound tasty?
No. Ugonit? And it wouldn't catch whatsoever. That's the problem.
All the Language Academy's new words will eventually end up in the historical dictionary. But sometimes these new words just don't catch on. At birthday parties across Israel, a cupcake may just stay a cupcake. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
We have lots more on how words evolve in Hebrew and in many other languages in our podcast, The World in Words. Just go to pri.org/language. For our next story, I don't mean to rub it in for all you soccer fans out there, but what a game last night, right? In case you were not glued to your TV like I was, the U.S. team was just seconds away from beating Portugal at the World Cup. When Portugal scored, the game ended in a draw. Talk about deflation. Now the U.S. fate at the World Cup depends on, well, honestly, it's pretty complicated. Anders Kelto can explain, though. Before becoming a reporter and working with us here at The World, Anders lived and breathed soccer. He played for the U.S. men's under-17 team and in college, too. And last night, Anders was watching the U.S. game from his home in South Africa. Now he says there are a few scenarios to consider at the World Cup.
Well, the good news is the U.S. controls its own destiny. They have one remaining game against Germany, who's pretty much the best team in the group. If the U.S. wins or gets a tie against Germany, then they will advance to the next round. Things get a little bit trickier if the U.S. loses to Germany. In that scenario, then it all depends on what happens in the other game in the group, which is Portugal against Ghana. If those teams tie, then the U.S. will advance even if they lose to Germany. So just, it's getting a little confusing here, but just stay with me.
It's getting quite confusing. You actually made a flowchart and posted this on Facebook today, and that's why I thought we need to try and explain this, but I'm not sure it's explicable.
Yeah, it's sort of hard to follow. But to summarize, if the U.S. wins or ties, they're through. If they lose, then it depends on what happens in the other game, and it would be best for there to be a tie in the other game.
I mean, this seems to be just part and parcel of the U.S. team's narrative going back many years. Just when you think we've got it in the bag, something goes horribly wrong. I mean, it's really about if all the goals and wins had been there, the U.S. wouldn't be in this position, basically, right?
Yeah, I know. It was so tantalizingly close to being one of the greatest U.S. soccer victories in the World Cup ever last night. They played well. They came back. They scored a late goal. It looked like they had it sealed. But then, you know, the U.S. soccer fan in me and in all of us has sort of been conditioned to expect the worst. So when we gave up that late tying goal with like less than 30 seconds to go, in a way, it almost wasn't surprising because that would have just been too easy for us to get two wins and already be through to the next round. That's just not the way U.S. soccer works.
So I gather that Germany and the U.S., they'll play on Thursday. It's actually in Germany's best interest to have a tie at this point.
If the U.S. and Germany tie, then Germany will win the group and the U.S. will advance. So there are already sort of these conspiracy theories floating around that Germany and the U.S. are going to agree to just not try very hard and play for like a 0-0 draw. I can't see that happening. Both these teams have a lot of pride. They're competitors. They both are going to want to win. But that said, both teams know in the back of their mind that they're going to be fine if they tie. So that may creep into their psyche over the course of the game. And the longer it stays 0-0, the more you may see the team sort of focusing on defense and not taking too many chances going forward. So there is a possibility that we're going to see a little bit of a snoozer. But again, that's not the U.S.'s track record. I mean, U.S. World Cup soccer games are almost always exciting end-to-end affairs. And I somehow feel like the game Thursday is going to be another one of those.
Well, the U.S. coach, Jürgen Klinsmann, is German. Is that playing into any of the conspiracy theories?
That's a good question. He's very close friends with the German coach. They coached together for Germany for years. But I think you won't see a conspiracy theory. If anything, you'll see a little bit of competitiveness. And those guys are both going to want to win the game.
Reporter Anders Kelto in Cape Town, South Africa. Thank you very much, Anders, and get some beauty sleep.
Thanks, Margo.
And speaking of that game last night, Izzy, our World Cup predicting ocelot, was watching too. He sort of got that one right. His handlers say he's just nuanced. Early Portugal goal, American onslaught, and a final sickening draw. Now Izzy's getting ready for his next prediction, the U.S. versus Germany match. So stay tuned and tweet at our psychic feline. He's at Izzy Picks, IZZYPICKS. It's The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. When it comes to world wars, it's World War II that captures American imaginations. Maybe it's the passage of time, but it just seems that World War I is hard for Americans to get excited about. In popular memory, the First World War is bookended by the colossal sacrifices of the Civil War and the heroism of the greatest generation of World War II, not to mention so many recent troubles to process. Can we really cope with memories of a bygone war? In Europe, though, it's a different story, where the war began 100 years ago this summer. In a couple of minutes, we'll hear a story from Belgium, where the nation is going all out on commemorating the First World War. But first to the world's history guy, Chris Wolf. He's here to help us get a handle on why the First World War is such a big deal. What do you think, first of all, there are these different takes about the importance of World War I, Chris?
Well, first of all, Marco, it's difficult for me to generalize about two continents' points of view. There's so many competing narratives, so I'm going to give you a bit more of a personal take. Mm. And it really comes down to three big things. Scale, obviously it was much bigger in Europe, much more European participation than American. The losses were so much more in Europe. The kind of memory of the futility of it, the nature of the fighting and what was going on. And just then the huge transformation of everything from popular culture, language, society, economy, politics, borders and identity. Just think in terms of English, the change in the language that you have, suddenly using phrases like going over the top, stuck in the trenches, no man's land, or just being left hanging.
Well, I know stuck in the trenches and no man's land. What's left hanging?
You're left hanging on the barbed wire. You're stuck in no man's land. You're a bit of a pickle.
You know, talking about war, we should also talk about peace, because it strikes me when I was watching Downton Abbey, there are all these references to the boys injured coming back to England. And there's a real kind of transformation of people saying war is not good.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like one of those defining, one of those transformative events is this perception of war as, let's not beat around the bush, it's a bad thing. Before World War One, people were saying it's great, it's patriotic, it's manly. You look at the literature of the time, it's very, you know, Rudyard Kipling, rah-rah, empire, and all that. And then after the war, it's a complete change. You know, you're looking at the war poets, the kind of All Quiet on the Western Front genre of literature that kind of is across Europe and very much less present in America, just because Americans were so much less involved.
So when you say pointless, I think it goes to that kind of sense that, again, back to Downton Abbey, it really does kind of pick up on that sense of war is futile. What are we doing this for? Of course.
Yeah, I mean, and it's accentuated in World War One because at that time, military technology favors the defensive. So it's really hard to, you know, break through and move the front line. So basically that means in large parts of Europe, not everywhere, men are pretty much fighting over the same ground for month after month, year after year. And I don't want to unsettle people's minds, but just think what that means. The casualties are still all around you for months and years.
And as anybody who's ever visited Flanders in Belgium knows, those casualties are still right underneath your feet.
Yeah, acre after acre of them.
The World's Chris Wolf, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
The war commemorations for WW1 are underway in Belgium now, and they're not all somber. If you are so inspired, you can get World War I themed T-shirts, replica uniforms, even remembrance beer. There's also 1418, a musical extravaganza set during the war. The show's in Flemish, but the producers just debuted an English language version. Don Duncan has the story.
A bugle call every night at the Menengate Monument in the Flemish town of Ypres. Since 1928, this is how Belgium has commemorated the First World War. But this year, with the start of the 100th anniversary, this same bugle call is being heard in some unexpected places. like the 2,000-seater arena in the city of Mechelen, north of Brussels. That's where the Flemish musical extravaganza 1418 has been playing since April. It tells the story of four Flemish boyhood friends who go to war. The show is a spectacle, with a cast of 140 and a budget of more than $12 million. More than 200,000 tickets have been sold so far in its current run.
We are playing until the 20th of July. Maybe after the summer we can continue.
That's Anne Janssens, communications director for Studio 100, the Flemish production company behind 1418. Along with an extended run, the company has been exploring other revenue-generating possibilities, chief among them mounting an English-language version of the musical.
Oh, there he is, the war hero.
I'm sorry, Fonz.
What you did could have gotten us all killed.
We know.
For the English version, Studio 100 has kept the original Flemish ensemble cast, but they've brought over seven British actors to play the leads for a test show here. The story and the songs remain the same, only the language has changed. It's a lot of work for one performance, says Kayleigh McKnight, one of the British actors.
I think this is more of a test, and then I think they'll start discussing where to take it, because it would be a shame to do all this work for one show.
June 28, 1914. Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria is murdered by a Serbian nationalist.
When the lights went up on the English version of 1418 last week, the actors played to a full house. Zoe Zwiderski, who's British, was in the audience. She thinks the English version will go down well in the UK.
I would say 90% you could just take it and put it there, because I think the show is, as a whole, works.
And that's exactly what Studio 100 may do. This first test performance is likely to lead to more English language performances in Belgium. And if those prove popular, they would like to move the show to London or even New York. But foreign musicals have a pretty checkered past in the West End and on Broadway, says London-based theatre commentator Terry Paddock.
You have to really understand why it's successful in its current market and whether that will translate to the transfer market.
One of the reasons the show's working so well in Belgium is the country's deep connection to World War I. It's almost a living, breathing thing in this small country that witnessed so much of the trench warfare. The UK also has its own vivid memories of the war. But in the US, a musical about World War I may have less crossover appeal. Still, Paddock notes that the World War I themed show War Horse ran for 2 years on Broadway and is now on a North American tour.
You've got a huge audience that's seen Warhorse to date. So if these producers, they're able to tap into the interest for that production, that could bode well for them.
While 100 years ago, the World War paid little heed to borders as it raged across Europe, this year, the English language musical that commemorates that war will have to negotiate cultural borders with utmost care if it is to survive the battlefields of the West End and Broadway. For the world, this is Dawn Duncan in Mechelen, Belgium.
And I'm Marco Werman from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported in part by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the Trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi, by the Ford Foundation, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.